Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner Emory versus Royal Insurance.
May it please the court, Mr. Bob Roberts will present the argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes to respond.
Good morning. This case arose out of the death of Mr. McNeely, who was killed in an automobile collision in September of 1986. In 1987, the personal injury wrongful death suit was filed, and it was finally settled in 1994, 7 years after the suit was filed and 8 years after Mr. McNeely's death. It was done in a way by the parties. We agreed that we would try to raise the issue of whether or not prejudgment interest, in addition to the policy limit, was applicable under the policy.
Yes, question. Would Stowers, if the issue is negligent failure to settle that produces a judgment in excess of the policy limits, why doesn't that answer the entire question? It's immaterial whether interest is prejudgment or excess judgment if the argument is that the delay in settlement increases the amounts for which the insured is liable to pay, then the insurance company is liable for the excess over the face amount. Why don't Stowers just answer the whole question?
Well, it does with respect to extra contractual, but not to contractual claims. In other words, this is a contractual claim. Stowers, in the court's opinions, have never reduced the contractual claims that the party
had. Based on that answer, then we have to look solely to the policy. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Solely to the policy and the order of the Department of Insurance and the matters that are contained in the brief. In other words, there is nothing in the policy that speaks to the issue of prejudgment interest.
Well, it does, doesn't it? It does speak in a way by exclusion, doesn't it?
It doesn't exclude. It doesn't include, nor does it exclude. And that's the very reason that all this came up, is that ISO, which is the lobbying arm of the insurance industry.
Well, before we get to the board order, though, the contract says the company will pay, in addition to the limits of liability, these things. And these things are post-judgment interest, costs, and by not mentioning prejudgment interest, aren't they in effect saying, as the Court of Appeals said, that clearly this contract does not contemplate or cover prejudgment interest?
Well, other cases have said no, Your Honor, and it doesn't say yes, it doesn't say no, and the court can certainly take the position that because it doesn't list it, it excludes it. But on the other hand, it doesn't exclude it, and the writer of the policy and the department could have approved a form, and it could have been used. It did say we will not pay prejudgment interest.
By the same token, they could have approved a form that said, on automobile policies, we will, and they didn't do that.
Yes, but you see, the problem is the same language in the auto policy is existing in the general liability policy where everybody recognized the fact
they recognized it didn't cover it, did they?
No.
Why did they ask for an endorsement?
Why didn't they ask for more money? They didn't have to ask for the endorsement because they recognized that there was an uncertainty. In fact, is what ISO said is, quote, to handle prejudgment interest in a uniform and consistent manner.
They don't recognize an uncertainty. They say it's not covered and therefore we need an endorsement.
No, I'm talking about ISO at the time of this.
I'm talking about ISO.
Yes. But Your Honor, it says the standard liability coverages do not contain an explicit reference to prejudgment interest. It doesn't say it doesn't cover it. And then it proposed this endorsement to deal with this, quote, omission to allow for a uniform and consistent handling of prejudgment interest.
Well, if you can read the policy to include it, why do you need an endorsement?
Well, for uniformity. In other words, the general liability policies have been paying it all this time. And the auto policies that say the same identical thing don't pay it. And in answer to your question about why we need something besides Stowers, why should the insurer have to go prove that the insurance company was negligent for this entire period of time in order to get a contractual right?
Well, what concerns me is Justice O'Neill points out, to continue to use the phrase that this is based on a contractual right when the right that you assert is not specified in the policy, and as Justice Heck suggests, to remedy that you put an endorsement on the policy?
Well, there's no question it is not specifically stated in the contract. I mean, I'm here.
Does the whole argument change? If I remember, your case is what was tendered exhausts the policy limits. What about if there's a case where less than the policy limits are involved? Do you have a better argument, or do you still have no argument because you could say, well,
it doesn't matter because they would pay it within the policy limits. They admit that they owe it within the policy limits. So
yeah, but the same argument you could make there. Well, but you've held whatever you paid in this settlement for a long, long time, so you still owe us interest.
Well, they would pay it. They would voluntarily pay it, Your Honor. I mean, as long as it's within the policy limits, they agree they owe it. So, I mean, that's never a problem.
Okay.
The only problem exists when it occurs over the policy limits, and this court has agreed, or the courts in Texas have agreed, that in uninsured motorist coverage, that you can have interest over the policy limits. To me, the point is, how should prejudgment interest be handled as a consistent thing throughout the state of Texas?
Before you get to that, let's go back to what you were talking about, and that is the ISO order.
Yes,
and Bulletin 644.
Yes, sir.
You can see that actually refers specifically to other lines of insurance, but your argument is that it should be also applicable to automobile insurance.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. The language of the policies was identical. The same thing was not in the auto policy, that was not in the general liability policy, and it makes no sense for an insured or a general liability carrier to have that protection and not the insured of an automobile carrier.
I just want to make sure I understand the contours,
yes,
of your argument. Your position is that Bulletin 644 relates to general casualty insurance?
No. I simply say that...
What's the scope of the insurance you think Bulletin 644 relates to?
There's a stated list of them, and it's general liability, boiler.
Okay.
And some related general liability policies, such as they were talking about professional liability.
Okay.
As a form of that. I do not claim that the bulletin directly affects the auto insurance industry. No.
Okay.
What does Bulletin 644 mean when it says, please note that if prejudgment interest coverage is to be included in medical professional liability policies, companies must file an amendment to their approved medical professional liability programs?
Your Honor, I have no idea why that's there or how it came up.
Does that mean that if you want the coverage, you're going to have to explicitly say so?
Well, yes and no. I mean, if the policies don't already say the same thing, and I can't tell the court whether the clauses in the professional liability policies are identical to the ones in the general liability policies. I don't think they are. But basically, we do know that they are identical in the between auto and the general liability. The Court of Appeals recognized that this was merely a clarification of the policy. And what I think is the most important aspect of this is that the public policy should be that the policies are treated the same. Various kinds of coverage are treated similarly. In other words, that an insured under a general liability policy should not have more rights for the same language than one under an auto policy.
But why should it be the same if it's a different type of insurance?
I'm sorry?
Why should it be the same?
Well, because they are both designed to do the same thing. They're both designed to indemnify the insured for the same kinds of losses from the insured's negligence. So there's no reason for the insured to be entitled to indemnity for prejudgment interest for his negligence around his home and not for prejudgment interest for his negligence while he's driving his automobile. There should be a consistency there. I want to deal very shortly with the point of the interest rate and the evidence. The interest rate, we are governed by Kavnar. We are not governed by the statute. The suit was filed 3 days before the statute came into effect. Kavnar specifically had the compound interest in it. with respect to the evidence question raised, there's never been an attempt to show that the court abused its discretion, and the evidence would have been immaterial to the issue, and the court so ruled.
Well, if it was filed after the statute applies, would be that the other side of your argument?
Yes, sir.
So it's furnishing an interest rate for a period of time statutorily based on the fact that it's a contractual agreement?
No, Your Honor, the rate of interest is determined by Kavnar, and if the suit had been filed 4 days later, the statute that codified Kavnar would have been in effect, and its provisions would have controlled, but since the suit was filed before that became effective, Kavnar controls.
Wait. Let me ask you kind of a housekeeping question that I'd like the respondent to respond to if she disagrees with you. Who are the respondents in this court? I mean, is it just Royalty Indemnity Company? Is Royalty Indemnity? So Royalty Insurance Company of America is not a party in this court?
No, it's just Royalty Indemnity.
One more thing in that regard. Embry is the guardian of McNeely.
Yes.
Who's the name representative of the estate?
It's in the style. There is a named representative of the estate in the
style. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Beth B. Bradley will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. There are several important points which should determine the outcome of this case. We should determine that Royal Indemnity Company does not owe prejudgment interest in addition to its limits. The first is that Royal's policy does not anywhere specifically address prejudgment interest or obligate Royal to make those payments. Second is that the 1984 board order on its face applies only to general liability policies and has no impact on business auto policies. The third is that Royal breached no duties to its insured. Royal defended the case through settlement. Royal tendered its policy limits in settlement.
How do you respond? Mr. Roberts' argument is that even though the insurance is different, they'll be treated the same.
The insurance is different. As I understand the petitioner's arguments, they are that public policy cannot allow disparate treatment under disparate policies. That's simply not the law. Each policy is different. They have different terms. There are other provisions, including the definitions of insurers, that are different between the business auto and the general liability. Furthermore, the entire legislative scheme of how the policies are regulated and approved suggests and anticipates a difference in the policies. They're regulated under different subchapters of the Texas Insurance Code. Different divisions of the Texas Department of Insurance decide which forms. Business auto is a promulgated form so that all admitted carriers have to use the form that the department says they have to use. General liability, on the other hand, is a file and approved system. If the insurers want to modify their coverage, they file the proposed language, and the department accepts it unless there is some problem inherent in the language, so it's much less regulated. Under those terms, there's no reason why the policies have to be the same. And in fact, in this case, what happened is that ISO, an organization representing general liability insurers, wanted to expand their coverage. They filed a request and said, we want to add this endorsement. The department approved it. The mere fact that the business auto carriers did not want to expand their coverage for no increase in premium should not cause the policy to nevertheless be effective to accomplish that.
Let me ask you about a statement in your brief. You say in cases within policy limits, the insurer is still liable for prejudgment interest. And what's the basis of that conclusion?
The basis of that conclusion is that prejudgment interest should be considered as damages and therefore fall within the We have some dispute with the petitioners as to the effect of Kavnar and whether prejudgment interest is compensatory damages. I think that Kavnar, reviewing the history of the way prejudgment interest was treated at common law, when they abolished the distinction, they don't mean to say interest can only be interest and not damages. They mean to say you don't have to hide behind the term damages to allow parties to recover prejudgment interest. It's an indemnity policy. It makes sense that if the insured is going to be liable for prejudgment interest in addition to the main damage amount, the insurance policy should cover it. that seems equitable within limits. And we're not taking the position that we have no indemnity obligation whatsoever for prejudgment interest. Our position is simply that it, too, is capped like the ordinary damages would be.
So prejudgment interest is recoverable under the policy. It's just subject to the limits.
Yes. That's our position. I need to note that petitioner's position is that prejudgment interest is not damages, at least as I understand it, which would affect the question of what happens in a Stowers case, because it is our position that, yes, Stowers would come into play, and if you negligently refused to settle and negligently allowed a judgment in excess of limits, even if it was only the prejudgment interest that was in excess of limits, yes, you could trigger a Stowers problem.
But that's because of Stowers.
That's because
it's a tort case, not a contract.
Right. And that's also because we concede that prejudgment interest should be treated as damages within the insuring agreement. If it's not damages, then no, you wouldn't have a Stowers situation there. You just have this nebulous interest award that nobody's sure how to treat.
I'm a little bit confused under the general liability thing. Your comment was they made their request to include that. But did you say without or with charging an additional premium? Which way did they go?
When it was originally affected, ISO requested the change without any additional increase in premium. I do not know, and it's not in the record, as to whether subsequently that has actually affected the rates that they charge. We don't know.
Would it be a fair statement that if companies owed prejudgment interest in excess of limits, that they would adjust their premiums to account for that cost?
I think it's a fair statement that the business auto insurers certainly believe that they would.
That's what I mean, that the people who issue those companies.
It would be speculation on my part, but I assume that's one of the reasons why they didn't want a similar endorsement. And they are so rate-controlled and rate-regulated as it is, they did not want to provide free coverage. Now, I agree, in most instances, it doesn't matter, because if you are within limits, then the insurers are paying the prejudgment interest anyway. So it only matters in those cases that are at or near limits. And then, of course, you've got the hammer of Stowers if the insurer should negligently fail to settle.
I'd like to follow up on Judge Gonzalez's question. I understand that for general liability policies, there can be different promulgation techniques. There can be different definitions in the different policies. But the fact remains that the language in these two is the same. And is there a policy reason why we shouldn't treat the same language the same? I mean, I understand they're regulated differently, but give me a policy reason why we should treat the same language differently in other contexts.
Well, the policy reason would be that it's still a contract between two contracting parties, and there's no public policy reason to abrogate those contract rights or to usurp the rights of the Department of Insurance in promulgating the business auto forms. It's also a little deceptive when petitioners allege that the language is the same. In 1984, the language was the same. The reason that ISO requested the mandatory endorsement was to change the language. So that endorsement actually modified the language and added a provision that said, we will pay prejudgment interest in addition to limits unless we've offered it in settlement, and then we won't pay any more after that. Since that time, the language has been different. In 1987, that language was incorporated into the standard form of the general liability policies. It also is a bigger issue than simply general liability and auto. There is nothing that particularly ties those two together. Homeowners' policies, employers' liability policies, personal auto policies are also regulated. And while it's not in the record, those policies also have language that is different from the general liability policy. In fact, the employer's liability and the personal auto have the same language as the business auto. The homeowner's policy and the insuring agreement specifically says that prejudgment interest is damages. So there is no public policy. It's more of an absence of public policy reason. There's no reason why we need to treat all coverages the same. There's no reason why all insurers need to do that. Just as there's no reason why business auto and general liability policy insurers should have to write the same limits. The insured can purchase different limits. If they're having an exposure problem where their prejudgment interest is consistently going over their insurance, they need more insurance. And they can purchase that for an appropriate premium. The other argument that petitioners rely on is that a rule like this is needed to encourage settlement. We simply disagree. There is no more rule needed to encourage settlement. Insurers have got the point, we know. we are already obligated to pay prejudgment interest within limits. If there is a delay in settling, prejudgment interest will accrue. If it accrues under Kavanaugh, it is going to be quite substantial if there's a delay. There's also Stowers exposure if the insurer fails to settle within limits. And as I've said, I believe that would also apply if the ultimate excess judgment is only excess by the interest portion. In addition, the insurer is incurring defense costs in addition to limits as the case continues. So if they are simply avoiding settlement to allow the case to delay, they're going to be paying out a lot more than limits on those other items that are already covered. We do not need another rule. Petitioners rely on the Potomac Insurance Company versus Howard case, which is a moderate case out of Houston. There's very little reasoning in that opinion to support any position. Our position would be that Potomac is not very well reasoned, and it seems to be confusing both insurability of damages and recoverability of damages, and also confusing the issue of breach of contract and what is owed under the contract. They seem to be allowing prejudgment interest as a sort of a breach of contract remedy, but it's actually not very well explained, so we think Potomac is distinguishable, that our position is consistent with Kavanaugh, consistent with the policy language, consistent with the legislative scheme.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
The legislature, when it passed prejudgment interest statute, did something very interesting, and that was that they prescribed a time before prejudgment interest would begin to run. And that time was prescribed for the express purpose of allowing settlements during that time without accrual of any prejudgment interest. And if you look at what happens when a person has a claim against him or her that's covered by insurance, the insurance company has the right to defend and the right to settle as they see fit. It should not allow the insurance company, but this court should not allow the insurance company to unduly delay the settlement of cases because they, in particularly large cases, because the larger the case is and the more its potential goes over the limits of the insurance policy, the more the insured is subjected to potential liability. The insured is not protected. The insurance company in these large cases can settle one that's obviously 20 times larger than the policy, or at least make the offer within a reasonable time. And that is the idea of prejudgment interest, of the burden of it going from the insured to the insurance company. The ISO people, when they came with respect to this, this general liability policy, recognized the problem was not limited to general liability policies because their very letter said, ISO recognizes that, quote, standard liability coverages, and that's all the liability coverages, have this same problem. None of them had any either inclusion or exclusion specifically of prejudgment interest. And the board and ISO recognized that that was an omission. And that was the very words that were used by ISO. This was an omission. They did not ask for more money because they recognized it was something that inherently should be covered by the policy and did not require any additional premium because of the fact that the premium already included it. Now, the delay in these cases is only going to be caused by the insurer's conduct. It cannot be caused by the insurer's conduct. There is no reason, again, for one kind of liability coverage to be treated differently from another kind. We're not asking for disparate treatment of disparate policies. We're asking for identical treatment of policies with identical language in them. The general liability policy's language is identical, or was identical when all this came up, to what the auto policy was then and is today. And if that was an omission at that time as to that policy, that portion of the policy remains the same today. And it's still an omission. It is still something that is not clearly defined. And that is the very reason for the board's order. And the board was recognizing that it was a clarification.
Why hadn't the board come back after all these years and added it into the auto policy?
I can't give you any answer to that. The only thing I can say, is, and it would sound like a plaintiff's lawyer if I said it, so basically, which I am, but basically...
Well, you can say what you believe.
I believe the insurance industry has a whole lot of control over there at the board. And I believe nobody's ever raised it. I mean, the insurance industry, nobody, no auto policy company's going to go over there and say, excuse me, this is, you've now said that this requires prejudgment interest in general liability policies. Do you mean that for auto policies too? No. They're going to be as quiet as little mice about it, and I wouldn't blame them. I don't blame them.
But we begin with, I think we begin with a common point that the contract is silent about prejudgment interest.
Absolutely.
And so for the court to conclude that it is in that contract, you rely on public policy notions. Which is the encouraging the insurance company to settle, keeping the insurance company from kind of just arbitrarily withholding paying the funds because they can go earn interest elsewhere. And so you're drawing on the policy concerns for why the insurance company should be responsible for prejudgment interest.
Well, that's part of it. But I mean, this, after all, is what we call a contract of adhesion. Is one that the insurer does not have the right to bargain. And I know that that's not a popular concept
these days. But the court has said if this is a first-party contract for insurance, then we impose the good faith and fair dealing. We've said, though, if it's a third-party liability policy, there is no duty other than Stowers, which is if there's an opportunity to settle within the policy limits, and the insurance company negligently fails to do so, and then is liable for the damages beyond. Why do we need to go any further on the policy argument other than to say, insurance company, whether you consider damages or interest, insurance company concedes it's responsible up to the policy limits. If the damages, as the insurance company concedes them to be, exceeds the policy limit, then there may be a cause of action by the insured under Stowers, which is the duty that exists to be liable for that excess because of, for what you said, was the reasons. The delay in the settlement, the lack of push for them to have settled, and their conduct caused that additional interest. Why doesn't that fit that scenario?
It does for extra contractual causes of action, Your Honor, but that there's no reason that a person should lose his rights if this contract of adhesion, by its silence and its as they described it, is.
But isn't that what Stowers was? Isn't that where we created the good faith and fair dealing? That's a duty outside of the contract because it is a contract of adhesion. And isn't that when we said in Stowers? That's where most states call that a duty of good faith and fair dealing. We just had the Stowers case, and we just held to that. Isn't that why we imposed the tort? Was because the contract itself, or we were unsure that the contract itself was providing sufficient protections for the insured, so we imposed the tort?
Well, but if the contract doesn't require this coverage, then the insured has no contractual right to it. He may have a tort right to it, but then that requires the insured to go prove a tort cause of action that has other elements in it, when all he should have to prove on a breach of contract or a contract recovery case is just how many days interest accrued. And that's all he has to prove. The contract was in effect, and it was the prejudgment interest was X dollars. And there's no reason to take away the contractual cause of action because there is an extra contractual cause of action. Now, I understand the court's concerns with the silence of the policy. That's a totally different matter.
But you concede that we have to impose that as a condition under the contract because the contract's silent.
Well, you have to interpret the contract to mean that or to say it's ambiguous in that regard. The silence or the omission of it creates an ambiguity. The ambiguity then in the contract of adhesion.
You can't create an ambiguity to require the use of the extraneous things that you indicate are necessary to decide this case. Am and what you just said is exactly that theory.
Well, Your Honor, I think on the face of the document, it doesn't say whether it covers or whether it doesn't cover.
I'm having a hard time following that. If it's ambiguous, there might be an issue about whether it's included up to policy limits, but how can the ambiguity make it cover beyond policy limits?
Because the supplemental payments clause requires payments of other things, and it's ambiguous as to whether the supplemental payments include pre-judgment interest. They do include post-judgment interest, and those are specifically in addition to the policy limits, stated policy limits. So the reason that it would be included, if at all, in the supplemental payments clauses, which says that in addition to the limits, the carrier will pay the following things, and it talks about court costs and bonds and that sort of thing, and post-judgment interest, pardon me. And so that is the area where it would be dealt with, because that is the area where other similar or like kinds of expenses are dealt with.
But what about the doctrine of the expression of one is the exclusion of the other? By expressing post-judgment interest, aren't they stating what they mean by supplemental payments?
Well, Your Honor, I think we can find a Latin maxim to mean to go with any concept we want to have. And certainly that concept, if this court feels like that they're that absolutely means that there's an exclusion, then there's an exclusion. But there are other factors in contracts of adhesion, and those are not dealt with identically to some negotiated contracts where the parties are at arm's length. And also, in most parties between individual persons, there is not the public policy matter that we've talked about here today.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in today's causes. The marshal will adjourn the court.